Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, Internet Radio. Good afternoon. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. Thank you so much for tuning in. Food Book Fair, in case you don't know, if this is your first time listening, we are an annual food media festival celebrating food media, ranging from our favorite cookbooks, memoirs, food magazines, and food podcasts, food film. So anything that has to do with food and media, we basically eat that up with a spoon. I'm Amanda Dell. I am one of the hosts of Recommended Reading, where we get to take a deeper dive into some food media with some of our favorite friends and collaborators. We are down one Food Book Fair Recommended Reading host today, so I'll just put that out there. My co-director and co-host Kim is doing something pretty amazing, which I just want to give a shout out to. She is headed to Detroit right now to participate in something called the Allied Media Conference. If you want to check out a little bit more about it, head to alliedmedia.org. And what they're doing with some friends and colleagues is they're presenting for the first time a food track. They are called Food Matters. And some of the things that they hope to explore, I will read a sentence or two from what they have shared on the website, is they want to explore their personal and collective food stories and use media-based practices to examine food and its many connections to resistance and liberation. So they've assembled a awesome team down there in Detroit. If you're headed to Ally Media, give us a shout, tweet at us, at Food Book Fair. Tell us how excited you are to be there. And we wish you all the best, Kim. We miss you. But we'll hold down the fort here. So, do you. I'm so excited to be joined in the studio today with a very old friend of mine, Mark Rosati, the culinary director of Shake Shack. I would invite him here ordinarily just to, you know, talk about anything because he's a cool dude. But he just happened to have released a book, also with Randy Garuti. I'll introduce Mark, and then we'll talk a little bit about Randy, too. But it's called Shake Shack, Recipes and Stories, and spent some time looking at it. It's a really exciting book. I think it's both extremely, you know, takes an extreme inside look at Shake Shack, but also is something that is really functional. And you can, you know, when you want to just stay home, but you kind of want to scratch that Shake Shack itch, you can do it kind of your way, following some recipes. In a minute, we'll get Mark on here and get him chatting. He's definitely not shy, so we'll see what we can get out of him. But I'll keep our tradition going by quickly talking about what I've been reading, watching, and or listening to. Full disclosure, I haven't been reading that much. Sorry, fans. I've been doing some more active things over the past couple days. One of the best things that I did was go to Dia Beacon. I had never been there before. Wow. Mind blown. I was not expecting that in the slightest. I don't know what I was expecting, but just getting to see like the Richard Serra sculptures in that kind of, it's kind of like a slightly subterranean basement level, or maybe, or just a setting that I had never seen them before, getting to interact with them, go inside. Anytime I had seen them in the city, it was just always so crowded. So that was really thrilling for me. And they have a great Dan Flavin like light installation that's in the basement. And that is really one of the most amazing settings for something like that. So I crossed that off my bucket list. And the other thing I did, which was pretty awesome, was I went to see Crooklyn in 1994, Spike Lee movie. And it was part of a collection of films being shown at Metrograph. I don't know if you haven't been to Metrograph, highly recommend. It's one of my favorite places to see a movie. And so there was a fellow filmmaker and also writer, Brandon Harris, who had come up with many different films over the course of the weekend to kind of celebrate and also, you know, draw attention to his new book called How to Make Rent in Bed-Stuy. So Crooklyn was a really cool movie. I'd never seen it before. there's one funny scene where the mother character is forcing her child to eat black-eyed peas. And that really stuck with me as a kind of a food takeaway. He wasn't into them, spoiler alert. So it was a really, as a New Yorker, it was great to see, New York shown and referenced in that way. It takes place in the early 1970s, all on one block in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. Getting to see also the bodega culture. There's a lot in the movie about that and about how important the bodega was in daily life at that time, who hung out there. A lot there. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It's a real good summer jam type of movie and a little bit surprising. So that's what I've been not reading, but watching and listening to and doing. So without further ado, I will welcome Mark Rosati to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda. This is a pleasure.
this is really fun.
It is.
So thank you, Heritage Radio Network.org, for letting me do this. I just basically get
clapping
to
along too.
Yeah. Catch up with people that I really respect, and I'm excited to always hear what they have to say as well. And full disclosure, Mark and I used to work together a long time ago.
Yeah.
We won't give away how long ago that was, but we started at this restaurant called Gramercy Tavern, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But first, I need to ask Mark what he's been reading or watching or listening to. So tell us.
You know, I haven't been reading so much right now, full disclosure.
Whoa. All right.
I do travel a lot for work, and carrying around a book, it would just be very difficult. I know I could always get like a Kindle and keep it simple. But to be honest with you, I don't know where this started from, but I'm actually get excited to get on a plane and read like the airline magazine, because it usually has a lot of great book recommendations. It talks a lot about different cities and gives you insider tips. So I feel like I'm learning as I'm flying, and it's kind of really well written and interesting. So it's kind of a cheat.
I think a delivery of books to you sounds in order from me.
I would appreciate that. But I actually recently got Netflix. And again, like, I'm so far behind the curve on this. Like, I was I moved apartments a few years back, and the cable guy just like slipped my mind. And the next thing you know, like a month or two into me living in this apartment, I had never had a TV to watch. I actually stopped watching TV, and it was fun because I really made a point of like going outside and exploring New York City. I would not get home as early as I used to watch my show, so I had fun. But now that I have it, I am like totally geeking out on Netflix. And probably the last thing that I saw, and again, I'm probably coming late to the party on this one.
It's okay.
But is Master of None.
You're not late at all. I think people are discovering this show. It's one of my favorites.
It's so well written, and it's so New York. And I love anything that's like a love letter to New York City. And I love to watch a show and be like, I know that restaurant, or I know that street. And like, I feel like the what they talk about in New York, it shines a spotlight on our city. And I love that because it's a very loving spotlight, I think, they put on New York. And the funny thing was that I was actually in Italy. And I think the start of this season takes place in Italy, in Modena. And I was in that city. And the whole thing started because a friend texted me after I Instagrammed. I was in a restaurant. He goes, hey, man, like, I'm watching this new Master of None show. And Aziz Ansari was in that restaurant on the show. I'm like, oh, I got to watch this show. I got back home after my trip. And like the first two episodes, all the restaurants, all the streets he was walking on the show, I'd been to, and I walked down those streets. So it was like kind of a fun way of like reliving my vacation.
Okay. I was just going to ask. So was this a vacation or was this a work research trip?
This was vacation. Okay. I'm Italian American, and my parents were so ashamed of me until like 2 years ago.
I'm sure that's not possible.
I'd never been to Italy. And I think they used the phrase sin against God, that I had not been to my home country. And
oh, wow.
I was like, oh, okay, I can go there. So I went to Rome for the first time, and it was more than I ever thought it would be. We just fell in love with it. But as like a person who loves food, and like growing up, like, and like seeing Mario Batali cook and him always talking about Emilia Romagna and this region where bolognese and tortellini and parmesan come from, that has always been the top of my list. So I finally had the chance to go. I went for 5 days about a month ago. And it just blew my mind.
And, so you loved it.
Oh, my God. From start to finish, just like their cured meats and like the simplicity of their food. I was like, I need to come back. I have to come back more often. So I also had to make my parents happy and start to say they have a son again and not disown me. But
do they expect a full report back?
I show them a lot of photos. Okay. I took photos of menus too. I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm eating. Like, it's beautiful. And then they're like, darn, now you're inspiring us to go back. Mm. So I think that's good. I think it's good.
So who was there first in Modena? Aziz or you?
Aziz, I believe. Okay. Yeah. And it was funny. I feel like we had friends in common that both recommended similar restaurants, because one of the ones he went to in the show is this tiny little restaurant where there's only four tables. But the restaurant, the guy who owns it, like going back, you know, like 100 years ago, was the first person that got the idea to actually sell balsamic in a store. In the past, it was just made in everyone's home. Everyone had barrels of balsamic. It was like what you did as a person living in Modena. And this restaurant, Giusti, it's called, this is the first man to actually say, you know what? Maybe some people don't have the time or the wherewithal to store like gallons of balsamic. I'm gonna bottle my own and sell it to make it easier. So it's a very cool place and probably one of the best meals and best experiences I had on that trip.
Okay, wow. So the balsamic is something that's native only really to that region. And that's something that they're known for.
Yeah. Modena is like the heartland when it comes to balsamic. Okay. And there's like different certification. So it's protected and has to come from certain regions and age a certain way in certain woods using certain grapes. And I had no idea it got like it went down this much. But it's almost like how wine is protected. Okay. And if it comes from Modena and it has these like certificates, you got the real deal. And it is pretty wonderful stuff.
So the Italians take their food and drinks pretty seriously, right?
Oh, my God.
That became apparent.
Yeah, and I mean, any culture where, like, while you're eating lunch, you're talking about what you're going to have for dinner, I'm all about that. So I fit in just perfectly over there.
It sounds like an amazing trip. And, you know, Aziz, if you're listening, you should hit Mark up. You know, maybe he'll take you to Shake Shack or something. You never know. Cool. Well, that sounds super awesome and definitely want to get into talking about a little bit more about travel a little later in the show, because I know that's a huge part of what you do. But yeah, I think let's take it back and start from the beginning. As I mentioned, Mark and I really go way back, and we worked together at Gramercy Tavern at, I think, one of the most amazing, a really amazing time there, because, and you spoke about this in the book. And again, if anyone's just tuning in, Mark Rosati is with us. He's the culinary director of Shake Shack, and they've just released a book, Shake Shack Recipes and Stories. So you can you know, Mark shares a lot about his journey, about how he got to where he is. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the book, and then we'll talk about, you know, how you got to where you are. So basically, you talked your way into a job working at Gramercy Tavern when Tom Colicchio was the chef.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that for me.
That was a very surreal moment for me, because I had been a fan of Gramercy Tavern for years before I actually met him. And I knew of him. He had a cookbook that came out that I bought called Think Like a Chef. Still one of my most inspirational cookbooks I've ever picked up. And I just was in love with the restaurant. It would be my special occasion restaurant. If I got great grades in college or I had family in town, we were going to Gramercy. We're going to sit at the bar and have a wonderful meal and drink amazing cocktails. But at the same time, I was really interested in making food at home. Okay. So anything I could do to learn how to make restaurant quality food in my little apartment, I was all about it. And I would do some research and find out like where Tom or Gramercy was like buying their meat. So I'd call up those guys and get the meat that I'm cooking at home, and it did not taste like Gramercy. It didn't taste like Tom. Like, what am I doing wrong? So when I met him at a food and wine event, I just started losing. I started geeking out on him. I'm like, so like the steak in the tavern, like those onions, like, do you add the balsamic in the beginning of the cooking process, or do you just add a tiny bit at the end? And like, is there sugar in there because it tastes sweet? And he's like, whoa, man. He's like, either you're losing your mind right now, or you like, you really care about food. He's like, either way, here's my business card. Come into Gramercy and like watch service one night. Be our guest in the kitchen. It was Tom Colicchio and his chef de cuisine, John Schaefer. And both were such wonderful people. And I called them the next day. I set up my kitchen trail. And I went in the next Sunday that I met him. And the funny thing is, I've never been in a kitchen. I've never been in a restaurant. I didn't know what to do. I show up wearing a suit and tie.
This is one of my favorite stories that's included in the book. I love this.
And it's funny because I didn't know. And neither John or Tom were in the kitchen that night. It was one of their sous chefs, Billy. And he walks in the kitchen. He just takes one look at me. And he's like, oh, my God, this guy's in. What am I doing? Who will let this guy in? He goes, he takes me downstairs. He takes me away from everyone in the kitchen. He goes, listen, man, I'm going to be honest. You get your ass kicked going to a kitchen dressed like this. He's like, don't ever do it again. We have chef whites we're going to put you in. We're going to forget this is ever going to happen. Just put on the clothing, come upstairs, and we'll get you started on this. So I'm like, yes, thank you, chef. Sorry. I go upstairs. And then he just had me stand the front of the kitchen for almost the entire evening. He's like, as much as you want to see, whenever you want to leave, I stayed the entire service because I'd never seen food cooked at that level, being married together on plates and brought up, and the chef looking at it, a final sprig of like herbs, a little bit of salt, sauce, and out it goes. Right. And I was seeing dishes that I had had before, and I was like, oh, so that's how they do the lamb. And just the smells, the ballet, the whole excitement of a kitchen, the adrenaline, I was hooked.
I felt the same exact way. I had never really worked in a restaurant of that caliber. I started as a host working there. They treated us to a trail in the kitchen when we started, and I was completely awestruck with the operations, how the kitchen functioned. I was completely seduced by it. So I totally understand where you're coming from.
I had never thought about working professionally in a kitchen. It just wasn't in my mindset. Again, I always said I'm an outsider. I love food. I'm the diner. I'm the guy that comes in and like pays love and respect to the chefs and all their hard work. But there was something really that was going on that day. I'll never forget the meat roaster. I went to the back of the kitchen where that station was, and I saw the chef pull out this piece of sirloin from the oven. He threw this big chunk of butter in the pan. As it started to melt and foam, he had a little bit of garlic and thyme, he just started basting that meat, and that smell, that was it. Yeah. And he had burns on his arm that looked like tattoos. I go, wow, that's cool. Like, I want that. I want it. So, and again, like, Tom and John were really cool. I emailed them the next day, thanked them for the trail. I said, if you ever need anyone to come in and peel carrots or wash your stove, I'm your guy.
So I'm sure they took you up on
they
that.
They did. And the funny thing was, like, it was grueling work. I mean, like, they gave me buckets of onions to cut, and they all had to be a perfect, like, say, quarter-inch square. If it wasn't, like, I remember one time I got to the very end of the bucket, and I was done. My hand was all cramped up because I had never done work like that before. Sous chef comes and he takes a look and goes, oh, man, this is a bummer because I know you've been doing this for 3 hours. He goes, but you see, this onion's really big. and this one's really small. The small one is going to burn, and the onion, then the big one's going to be raw. We have to throw these away. So we took this big bucket and threw it in stock to finish making the stock. And then he goes, you have to start over. But the funny thing was, I was still into it. And yes, I cut onions, but I was also like cleaning bone marrow and cleaning wild mushrooms that I only read about. So the more I did it, the more addictive it got. And finally, John Schaefer says, you know what, man, we can't get rid of you. And you know what, we kind of like you, so you want a job. And that's when I was like, wow, actually getting paid to do this and being a cook. And that's how it all started.
Amazing. I remember it almost like it was yesterday. I can remember that kitchen really well.
It was such a magical experience. As you were saying earlier, It was such a great time to be at such a legendary New York restaurant, because a year and a half into my time there, Tom left.
Right.
And he wanted to focus on his craft empire. And that's when Mike Anthony came in. And talk about two giant chefs occupying the same kitchen in the transition period.
I remember that. That was exactly right when I started.
Wow. What a time. Like, talk about being a fly on the wall to see those change in styles. And I learned so much. And Mike Anthony is just, I mean, I can't say enough good things about him and what I learned. But I think the most humbling thing was seeing him come in, and like the first day he was just going to watch us cook, and I'm like roasting meat that night, and I go, he's like looking over my shoulders, I'm putting meat in the pan, and he says to me, wow, I like how you're cooking that steak. I'm like, is there something wrong? Do you want me to do it differently? Do you want me to put more oil or less oil? Should I season it differently? He goes, no. He goes, you guys are awesome. He goes, this restaurant is a success. You're doing something right. I need to understand what you guys are doing before I even start to think about doing something that feels right for me. He's like, so you don't change anything. He's like, I need to absorb what you guys are doing. And he meant every word of it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very cool experience.
This is going to be fun, because I can tell that Mark has a really, really good memory. Especially about something like that. Then take us through a little bit about how do you go from being a cook at Gramercy Tavern to starting at Shake Shack. What inspired you? How did you get there? Talk to us about that a little bit.
I have to be honest, and I think about this sometimes.
Hopefully.
And I feel like I feel like I still don't know how this happened, to be honest with you. It was like there's a very turbulent time for me in terms of like my next steps and like in the restaurant business, because now I'm hooked. I'd done 3 years of Gramercy under two wonderful chefs. I worked all the stations in the kitchen, and I started thinking about what my next step was. And I was passionate about food. That's what got me into the business. But actually, the restaurant business in general was pretty exciting. And I didn't want to be a cook or a chef in the kitchen that was very frustrated with how the front of the house was working, where maybe a waiter would come back and say, we need to slow that course down. Like, it's a couple, it's their anniversary, they're talking so much. The chef starts throwing pots and pans. Like, what do you mean? Like, I don't wait for them, they wait for me. It's like, I didn't want that. I wanted to understand how everything was integrated. I felt like I had a good grounding in the kitchen.
Right.
Now I wanted to learn the front of the house.
Okay.
And while I came to Gramercy because of Tom, and I stayed because I love Mike, it was really Danny Meyer, the owner of the restaurant and a legend in the restaurant business in New York City. And it was his culture that really had me hooked on like staying in the restaurant group. And I didn't want to leave, and but I was ready for my next step. I felt like I didn't want to stay at Gramercy because I'd already learned that restaurant. I want to see something new, something fresh, meet new faces, see different styles. And the only restaurant in the group at the time that I was looking for front of the house management, and I was grossly underqualified for management. I should have been a back waiter to start, but I saw Shake Shack had a job posting for management. I'm like, ooh, that would be fun. Like, you know, learn how to manage employees, work in the front of the house. This would be great. And at the same time, I also hesitated too, because I was like, well, wait a minute. I just went from cooking fine dining for 3 years, being trusted to cook foie gras and be given like white truffles because they knew I could like clean them really well and shave them like perfectly on dishes, to cooking a hamburger. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, again, it's kind of a good opportunity, but this is Shake Shack, this little place in a park. I actually was very hesitant after I accepted a interview. And the general manager that I was interviewing with felt it too. He's like, I don't know, man. He's like, you got 1 foot in and 1 foot out here. I don't know if I should take a risk on you for management. He's like, why don't you come back the next day and do an actual trail in the kitchen, spend time on the stations, talk to the team, and then see how you feel. At the end of the day, if it's not for you, that's totally cool. We'll just walkway. So I did. I went back, And now I'm here at the Shake Shack in the morning. I'm seeing the delivery come in. I'm seeing it's the same meat we were using at Gramercy Tavern. I'm seeing the vegetables are being prepped in-house. And then what blew my mind was toffee. We have toffee as one of our mix-ins for our frozen custard. We weren't buying Heath Bar Crunch. We were making that from scratch. And I'm like, well, why don't we just buy it? They go, well, you know, we were born out of fine dining. You know, our kitchen is across the street in 11 Madison Park. That's where we're making this stuff. You know, it's why buy it when we can make it? We control the flavor profiles. And that right there was like, oh, man, this is just like all of Danny's other fine dining restaurants, except it's a lot more simplistic. And our dining room is a park.
Right.
But it was actually one step further. When I saw how the team was interacting with each other and how there was the same culture that was very much alive at Gramercy Tavern, was at Shake Shack too, and it was like a Danny restaurant. I'm like, man, this is no burger stand. This is a Danny Meyer restaurant. Like, all of his ethos is very much alive here. I'm like, this is great. This feels like the right fit for me. I think I can hang for a year. And that was, my God, 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, excited to jump into the next chapter. We've got to take a short break and thank our lovely home away from home, heritageradionetwork.org. We are in a shipping container in the back of Roberta's, which is an amazing restaurant in Bushwick,
lovely restaurant.
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But if you like hearing from people like Mark and hearing other amazing food programming and other internet radio, you need to go to heritageradionetwork.org. The main important thing when you go there is check out all the shows. You can see who's hosting. We have shows about drinks. We have shows about being, you know, cooks and chefs in restaurants. We have shows about food policy. So click on that beating heart. Become a member today. Don't do it tomorrow. Don't do it next week. You just got to go on right now and do it. Spend some of that green on this amazing radio station that has been created in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So again, heritageradionetwork.org. Check it out, and we'll be right back with Mark Rosati.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Patrick McAndrew, host of Why Food on Heritage Radio Network, a show about creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries in the food industry and the stories behind their success. Tune in on Thursdays at 2 p.m. to journey through stories marked by triumphs, failures, and insights. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Welcome back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, and we are joined in the studio today with Mark Rosati, by Mark Rosati, culinary director of Shake Shack, and we're chatting about everything Shake Shack related and beyond, but also we're here to celebrate the Shake Shack's brand new book, Shake Shack Recipes and Stories. Exciting. So if you didn't catch that before the break, Mark has actually been with Shake Shack for almost 10 years. So we're really getting into how Shake Shack started, and also, you know, how Shake Shack went from really one hot dog cart into 134 locations worldwide. That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, a lot of people might not know that Shake Shack started as part of a public art project in Madison yep. Square Park to benefit Madison Square Park Conservancy.
Yeah.
And then from that idea kind of blossomed into the one location in Madison Square Park, right?
Yes.
Is that, okay.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because when the whole reason Shake Shack started, as you're saying, was to help the park. 15 or so years ago, Danny Meyer, the owner of Shake Shack, he opened two restaurants right across from Madison Park. One was 11 Madison Park, mm-hmm. and the other one was called Tableau, which is a now closed. It was an Indian restaurant with French accents. Both were absolutely stellar. Both were in these big, beautiful, cavernous spaces that were really warm and glowing and elegant. And Danny's like, this is fantastic. You know, I have great hospitality, wonderful chefs cooking really inventive food, great wine, great cocktails. He's like, but the only kind of bummer is these spaces have massive windows overlooking a very dirty park. And at the time, Madison Square Park was not what it is today. It was pretty much run down.
I know that firsthand, and I know that that's hard for some people to imagine, but you really like walked around the park.
Yes, you never walked through it. It was the scariest park in New York, and that's so funny as you say, because like now I think it's one of the nicest ones in all of New York City.
It's an oasis, really.
They have amazing art installations, they have great concerts, and this all started back during this time because the park was saying, what can we do to get out of this rut? So a conservancy fund was started to help revitalize the park. Danny Meyer joined the conservancy fund, and the first vision was, well, let's have more art in the park. And the first artist that they had was from Thailand, and he had been to New York so many times. He loved New York City. He goes, what I want to do, though, is I want to create my vision of New York City before I actually came here. I want to capture what I saw on TV.
Oh, wow. And, I didn't know that.
Which is a really cool idea. And he was like, when I would watch shows about New York City in Thailand, it'd be everyone's driving around these yellow taxi cabs and everyone's getting hot dogs. He's like, so that's my like vision as an outsider looking in. He's like, as a kid, he's like, so that's what I want to create. So what he did was he took old like 1970s taxi cabs. He put them up on stilts, and underneath them, he put these art installations on them. And then he scattered all these taxis around the park. So it was kind of a genius idea to give like New Yorkers an excuse not only to kind of go into the park, but also to wander around to find the different taxis and also kind of become familiar with the park again in the first place.
Oh, wow.
And explore.
There's some amazing. There's a really great photo of this in the book, actually. So if anyone has a chance to pick up the book and can leaf through it, it's right at the beginning, so you can kind of see exactly what Mark's talking about.
It was such a cool idea. And then he said, you know, okay, so the other part of my vision is a hot dog cart. And he gave it to Danny. He goes, you have these two restaurants across the street. Would you mind curating a hot dog cart? And Danny's like, oh, I love that idea. Now, Danny Meyer's from the Midwest, and he grew up eating Chicago-style hot dogs because he grew up in St. Louis, not too far from Chicago, and he also grew up eating other, like, summertime fare that was, like, very unique to his part of the world.
Yeah. Can you just tell us a little can you tell us exactly what a Chicago hot dog is?
A Chicago hot dog is from the Windy City, and what's cool about it is it has so many toppings, and I think what's unique about it is it also tells you the differences between New York City and Chicago. There are a lot of parallels here, but they're also different. Both love hot dogs. In New York, a hot dog is something you eat on the go. It's a snack. It's small. It's thin. You get a little line of mustard on there, maybe some sauerkraut. It's not lunch. It's not dinner. It's a snack. Chicago people are not cool with that idea. If you're going to eat anything, it's a meal. So the Chicago-style hot dog has all these different toppings. It has mustard, pickles, onions, relish, tomato, these spicy sport peppers. And then they put a little bit of celery salt on there just to bring it all together. They say it's actually dragged through the garden, the hot dog, if you will, with various different vegetables, pickled, raw, and everything in between. It's like the pizza, too. Chicago-style pizza, it's thick. Again, if you're going to eat a slice, it's a meal. In New York, it's a thin slice. It's a snack. So Danny grew up eating Chicago hot dogs. And then when Shake Shack started as a hot dog car, mm-hmm. you couldn't really find a Chicago-style hot dog. So Danny's vision has always been, let's do something familiar, but let's add to the dialogue. In New York City, people knew hot dogs, but they didn't know Chicago. So that's what he started selling. in addition to freshly made lemonade. And here's the best part, because 11 Madison Park became like the kitchen we did all the prep in, we were making Rice Krispie treats. We weren't buying marshmallows and melting them. We were making marshmallows.
Wow.
And then melting them down to make a Rice Krispie treat. And again, it's fine dining. It's the only way we know how to do stuff. We didn't know how to simplify. So when we opened the hot dog cart, there was a line day one because people are curious what Danny Meyer's vision of a hot dog cart would be. Hot dogs were good. People were excited. It was a good day. Day two comes. Some people in the offices next, like we're like around where the park was, mm-hmm. saying, you know what? That hot dog was good. I think I'm going to go back down again, line, get another one of those hot dogs. That was kind of tasty. And this is kind of where like the legend started to grow, because the people working the hot dog cart were the servers of 11 Madison Park. And of course, these guys are all about hospitality and making people happy. So they actually would recognize the people who went there the day before and remember their order. Go, hey, man, you work across the street. You like your Chicago dog without the spicy peppers, and you like your lemonade, no ice, right? Should I make that for you? And everyone's like, what? This is a hot dog cart? Because normally it's a very gruff experience. And that's where it started, because Shake Shack was really built off of our fine dining heritage. And it's not just good food, but it's also going to be great, thoughtful service too.
Wow. So the cart was successful. Yeah. I read a little bit about it in the book. It's kind of like after year three.
Yeah.
Was when some forces joined together with the city, the conservancy, and mm-hmm. like, okay, well, let's do something permanent. And
yes.
How long had the permanent shack in Madison Square Park been there before you came on board?
The shack as we know today, yes. was built actually after the hot dog cart. We
okay.
did the cart for three seasons. It was just in the summertime. All the money that we raised went to benefit the park, and we had lines every summer. The line got bigger and bigger. So the park's like, you guys are wonderful. You're raising money. You guys are a big draw. We're thinking about building a kiosk. Would you guys like to be considered for that? We said, absolutely. So we won the bid to operate the kiosk. It was a 400-square-foot kiosk. And now Danny is like, okay, so now I have to expand the menu, because now I have a kitchen I can cook right. in. It's not a cart. He's like, so I want to keep the hot dogs, because like that's the star of the show. And he starts to think back, like, what else he used to enjoy when he was growing up in the Midwest. And here's my favorite part of the story. And this is Danny goes into the park, sits on a bench with a piece of paper and a pen,
mm-hmm.
and in 5 minutes scribbles out his idea for
right.
what
right.
Shake Shack is. And we actually have a photo of that original sketch in the book. And actually that sketch is framed. It's in our CEO Randy's office, who's the co-author of the book. And 85% of what's on that napkin is the menu today at Shake Shack, which is mind-blowing to me.
It's pretty crazy. And also an amazing part of that is getting some different possibilities of names.
Yeah, and that's
right?
a cool thing.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite was Custard's First Stand.
Yeah.
And what was cool about it is like Danny's thinking to himself, okay, Chicago hot dogs. Now in St. Louis, he grew up eating griddled and smashed hamburgers. And
okay.
that's something that he's like, okay, we have to add that to the menu. And then frozen custard, which is a freshly made ice cream. And no one really knew it outside of St. Louis or the Midwest. But Danny's like, it's different than ice cream. It's creamier. It's denser. He's like, I want to serve that because that's what I grew up eating. And Shake Shack was almost like Danny's homage to his childhood growing up in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So that was the menu. We also added crinkle cut fries because there was a nostalgic value. And the funny thing is we tried so many fries.
I kind of remember this. I remember there was a lot of attention around the fries.
There was. And we loved the crinkles because A, there was a nostalgic value around seeing a crinkle shape. But the other thing is, out of all the fries we tested, those grooves, they picked up cheese sauce and ketchup better
yeah.
than any other French fries. It's a dunker. So we were like, yes, we got to go with that. So the menu was done. We opened the doors, and Shake Shack, as we know today, opened. This was back in 2004.
Wow.
And we thought it would be the hot dogs, and maybe people would get a burger. And we honestly thought we would cook for maybe 50 people a day, best for lunch, shut the doors, go to the beach for the rest of the day, come back, reopen, and just keep it going. And while we thought the hot dogs were going to be the big star of the show, we built the shack to reflect that. We didn't build a big kitchen to handle volume. We just thought, again, we'd be open for a few hours. The minute New Yorkers tried the burger, that's when the legend really took off.
Yeah, well, talk a couple of the words you used to describe the burger. You said griddled and...
Smashed.
Okay.
Yep.
So that was something that New Yorkers had never seen before, really, or hadn't seen that much, or it wasn't the style that we were used to.
It wasn't a very popular style back in the time, and I myself was a big burger freak back then. So before Shake Shack opened, I've been in the city, I think, since 98.
Okay.
Shake Shack opened in 2004. I was a burger fan, so I traveled far and wide. And every year the Zagat survey came out, I automatically turned it to best hamburger in New York City, then best pizza. And I felt New York did both really well, but that's where I wanted to spend my time and my money. So the burger places I were going to were either broiled, like Corner Bistro,
okay,
or they were grilled. And I think back to one of my favorite restaurant burgers, more fancified burgers, yeah, when I was younger, was Union Square Cafe.
Okay.
And so we had a lot of different styles, but the kind of idea of taking a burger, like almost like a ball, putting it on the griddle, and then smashing it down so it flattens out, and the meat actually makes full contact with the hot surface, and immediately it starts to sear and caramelize. That was something I had not seen ever before. Where I grew up in New England and Connecticut. We didn't have that style. Most of our burgers were grilled. But the idea of using like a griddle and smashing the meat into there and creating that caramelization, I had never seen that before. That was pretty cool for me. But the cool thing was, like, we wanted the burger to be simplistic. And Danny was thinking back to his childhood. I think we can all kind of relate to this, that the burgers we ate as children weren't complex. You know, most of us know, like, the burgers our family would cook for us, which was probably just a hamburger, cheeseburger with a couple ketchup, maybe right, a little bit of mustard on the side, some maybe fresh vegetables
that's
cut.
Controversial, the mustard.
But. Yeah. And then, like, he wanted to keep it simple, but he said, like, there's ways of making simple deceptively complex. He's like, we got to start with the beef. We need to use a really, really good beef. So we wanted to have no hormones, no antibiotics. We wanted it freshly ground. But what we found after a lot of testing is you can't use the trimmings of a steak to make a burger. A lot of butchers will take off the meat on the outside of the steak. So when you cut a steak, you have this beautiful, like, picturesque piece. And that's when you walk into the butcher shop, you see that steak, you go, that's dinner tonight.
The trimmed
steak.
Okay.
Now, the trim can't get thrown away because you're throwing money away.
Right.
So you take that trim and you grind it. The problem is all the flavor in a great burger is in the steak itself. You have to use that piece of meat. So Danny's like, no trim. It has to be the actual muscle itself ground. And then we started to play around. At the same time, we were working with a very famous butcher, Pat LaFreda,
yeah,
who was developing like his technique for crafting burgers at the same time. And Pat's like, there's so many wonderful cuts you can use to create a burger. Let's try them all. Let's find out like what we want to do. And what happened was Danny and Pat started to look at creating beef blends, almost like a winemaker would think about making a Bordeaux, where you choose different cuts or different grapes for different attributes. So after a while, Danny and Pat settled on this blend that's still the same blend that we use 10 years later, 13 years later, actually. And the cool thing was, I think in 2004 was a very cool time in New York City, because when we opened doing our style of burger, April Bloomfield opened up in the West Village doing a very different type of burger, working with Pat to develop the blend. And I think you look 13 years later, both restaurants, if someone asked me, like, if you're coming to New York City and you're going to eat burgers, I say, you got to go to Shake Shack, get our style,
right,
and then go get April's, because that's another excellent, excellent burger. And I think you can find those are like very different, excellent. And then there's so many more selections in between. But I think Pat back then, 2004 in New York, was a genius with how he was thinking, yeah, about bringing beef together.
Yeah. And the purveyors and the makers that you work with, like someone like your perfect example of Pat LaFreda, that's been an important carryover from kind of the mindset of fine dining to bringing that to the Shake Shack, celebrating the farmers, celebrating your purveyors, celebrating your makers. And that is something that's still extremely important to Shake Shack. And that's something that you work on yourself a lot. And
yeah,
not only finding the, you know, best quote unquote New York, you know, hometown heroes or, you know, our hometown people here, but also going into all of the different markets that you have and kind of infusing some, you know, some of the local flavors and local ingredients. into the Shake Shack menu. I know that's something that you work on a lot.
That's a big part of our company, and we actually start to think that way when we open our second location.
Okay.
We, for the longest time, when I joined Shake Shack, there was no... there was no idea of growth. We did not set out to open a Shake Shack to have 134 years later.
Wow.
It was built just to be a part of the park and be a commuting gathering place. And when people got off work, they want to come to the park, drink a beer outside New York City under the stars, eat a burger, come together and just hang out. We wanted to be the place. So that was it. That's what we were trying to do, just make Shake Shack feel really connected to the park. We actually added a ice cream treat for dogs. Because in Madison Park, there was like a little dog walk.
Right.
And all the neighbors would come there and throughout the day take their dogs so they could socialize with one another and walk around. And then the people would come and wait in line with their dogs. So we're like, wow, this is fun. Why don't we create like this custard sundae that has dog biscuits in there? So when the people come and get the burger and the beer, the dog's not left out. Again, we looked at our neighborhood and said, how can we be part of this neighborhood and just answer a lot of wants? When we opened the second location, this was on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, I believe in 2009, we said the same thing. We're like, we're opening a second Shake Shack. First of all, we didn't think it was going to work because we thought the real star of the show was Madison Park, that you can, you could be outside and eat food. We tried to take the Shake Shack and bring it indoors, and again, we did not think it was going to work, but we still wanted to localize the menu and kind of reach out to people in that new neighborhood in New York City and do something different. So our neighbors across the street was the Museum of Natural History. And what we decided to do was create a special concrete. And what a concrete is taking our frozen custard and putting it in a cup with different sauces and toppings and blending it at high speed so it's still frozen, kind of like a sundae but all mixed together, and you eat it with a spoon.
Sounds horrible.
It's absolutely delicious. And the idea behind it was open every shack with a different like concrete that's inspired by like the neighborhood. So the one for the Museum of Natural History, we call the Crunchstellation because there's a huge constellation room in that museum.
Yeah.
And we went one step further and said 5% of these sales from this concrete annually, we're going to donate to the museum because they're our neighbors. We want to support them. They're awesome. We want to be part of this new community. And again, we thought the second one actually became even busier than Madison Park when it opened. We were shocked to see that. But then we said, okay, maybe we can open a few more of these. We'll see what happens. But this is what we do. It's not cookie cutter. We want to make sure each shack has its own soul, its own feel, and is really built for the neighborhood. And that's what we feel is our voice amongst the fast casual segment these days.
Love it. Give me your favorite example of how you've done this.
I would probably say something that I was really excited about was we recently opened in Tokyo about a year ago.
Congratulations.
Which, thank
That's
you so
exciting.
Much. I mean, that was a huge, huge moment for us. But what we did is we flew over and we looked around. We said, wow, there's so much great food to begin with here. I mean, this is like more Michelin star restaurants in Japan than in any other country in the world. Like, there's a lot of great food here. So we didn't want to, say, ship in our custard or our cheese sauce. What we try to do is work local because the dairy there is excellent. We found people that could make our recipes for us because what we wanted to do is support that local community. Mm. And again, we wanted to make a very, very handcrafted Shake Shack just for Tokyo. And we created a lot of different menu items that we felt were really inspired by food that we ate while we were going over there to explore. I fell in love with black sesame.
Black sesame.
Black sesame. So only Shake Shacks in the world that sell black sesame milkshake. And the founder of our company, Danny Meyer, was over there earlier this year. And he writes us a note going, my God, this is the best milkshake I've ever had. He's like, you guys have to figure out how to get this to America. And I'm like, wow, thank you for saying that. But what we wanted to do was create a very special Shake Shack. So when we go to a new city or a new country, we are really committed to creating that community gathering place that has to be in sync, though, with that neighborhood. So we make sure our architecture is in sync and it feels like it fits in. And also, if we can reflect back some of the local culinary heritage that inspires us, we try to do that. Japan, I think, was a great example. Our first shack actually was in a park, just like the original one here in America.
Oh, wow.
So we had a lot of the tree elements coming in there, but we used different reclaimed local woods from Japan to make it feel like a very Japanese-inspired shack. But at the end of the day, if you get in line, you're from New York, and you order that Shack burger, it's going to taste the same, but we've localized all the ingredients. At the other point, you're going to get a lot of special milkshakes and concretes, like I talked about, using Japanese flavor that still very much feel like an American-inspired roadside burger stand, but with these other unique flavors laced in to make it feel special for Tokyo.
How awesome. It's just a way to, you know, bring a part of New York and Americana to a totally new city, but incorporate their traditions as well. And I hope one day I get to go over there and see it. So we're almost out of time, but again, Mark, thank you so much for being here. Mark Rosati joining us today on Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, Culinary Director of Shake Shack. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for having me here, man. It's just so wonderful to chat with you and catch up. It's been a blast.
I will leave us with one quick answer to my question, which is, if someone was going to the original Madison Square Park location of Shake Shack for the very first time, what should their order be?
Okay.
One person eating a one person sized meal for that day.
I would get our Shack burger, which is the star of the show. That's the burger that made us who we are today, and it's our signature cheeseburger. Again, all that beef I was talking about earlier, the blend, I think it's very much alive in there, and all the other toppings are just there to accentuate the beef, because the beef is the heart of a great hamburger. And I'd also get our Shackmeister Ale, which is our own beer that was made for us by Garrett Oliver, the head brewmaster of Brooklyn Brewery, which we started back in 2009, that relationship. The beer was designed specifically to match with the Shack burger.
Okay.
Garrett loved the bun of our burger, so we actually use a German hop in our beer to echo that bun flavor. And I think at the end of the day, you try those two together, you're going to really get a good idea of what makes us tick at Shake Shack.
Cool. Well, you heard it here first. You know what to order, according to Mark. So do that. And also pick up the book, Shake Shack Recipes and Stories. And you can have you can try out some of the recipes and see this and read about the stories firsthand from the people who started it, Shake Shack. Get it. It's really good. One of my favorites. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next week and on Recommended Reading. And keep reading.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.